Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Chesley Christ had it all, or so it seemed. She won the Miss USA crown, she passed the bar twice, and she had embarked on a promising career as an entertainment journalist. But the lows generated by heartbreak, betrayal, and persistent depression brought all of her success crashing down when she ultimately took her own life in January of 2022. Just prior to that, Chesley Christ was preparing to publish a book about her life, about the highs and the lows. She left that manuscript behind, but her mother, April Simpkins, was determined to have it published. The result is the book, By the Time You Read This, The Space Between Chesley's Smile and Mental Illness. Not only is it Chesley's story in her own words, but her mom expands on that story to share what she experienced in the days, weeks, and months following her daughter's death. Simpkins is a mental health advocate. She serves as an ambassador for the National Alliance on Mental Illness and is a board member of the Piedmont Tri-County chapter of that organization. And she joins us for the hour. Good morning and welcome. Thank you for being here.
Good morning. Thank you so much for having me.
Before your daughter died, as I said, she had written this memoir and she wanted to have it published. And she asked you, in a note that she left behind, to get it published, which is exactly what you did. It became important for you to do that. Why was it important to her that you do that?
It was something that Chesley spent a considerable amount of time working on throughout 2021. And there's messaging in there that I know she felt imperative to share. She initially was writing a memoir about a distinct period in her life. But in doing that, she drew on a lot of experiences and left her emotional feelings and her imposter syndrome and so many other things. She just opened the curtain and left it out there for people to see. And I know she felt people could relate to that. And it was just an important story to tell.
She left behind this manuscript that I don't believe you knew much about. I mean, maybe you saw segments of it, maybe you didn't. But you had to get it ready for publication. And you decided at some point to add your own thoughts to this book, which you've done in a part two of the book. When and why did you feel it would be important for you to be part of this book and your thoughts?
Thank you for that question. Chesley did not write her manuscript with her death in mind. She wrote this manuscript and had fully intended to promote it on her own. So there were some questions I believe people who would have read her manuscript would have still been left with. And I felt it important to share a little bit more about her struggle and also my grief journey, how that impacted my mental health, and certainly in hopes that that would help others who were left behind when a loved one dies by suicide.
You've kind of thrown yourself into this in telling Chesley's story in the hopes that it will help other people. I'm assuming that's the motivation behind all of this. But in your book, you write wrenchingly of the grief that you experienced in the immediate aftermath and then the lingering senses of grief that you continue, I guess, to experience. How difficult is it for you to have these conversations, to do these appearances, to do these interviews?
It is challenging, but it is good work. It took me some time, and I work with my own counselor and therapist to help me digest the words that I left on that page, revisiting those days, weeks, and months after Chesley passed. But for me personally, I gain strength when I'm talking to others about their journey. There's a comfort that we are able to offer one another. And I really truly believe that in sharing that pain, someone is going to feel normalized and think, I felt that way, or that is my story as well, and will follow me through that journey of finding some kind of purpose in that pain. it's certainly a journey. I am not, I've not left grief behind. Grief travels with me. I've just learned how to do life with grief, and I hope that there are others who, through this book, will learn that as well.
The two of you were very close, and we'll talk about that as we go through this conversation. Do you think she would be pleased that you decided to add your own thoughts to her own to her story in this book by the time you read this?
I truly do. I know, again, with Chesley not writing this book with her passing in mind, with Chesley leaving out the experience of her first attempt and the way she wrestled with whether or not she would reveal that, I do believe she would be really proud of me for sharing that journey and not just leaving it there in a place of pain, but talking about finding a place of triumph as a mental health advocate, really using this to help others. And that truly was the essence of who Chesley was.
I remember distinctly hearing about your daughter's death, and I know that, and thinking to myself, why is this so shocking to you? And I guess to me, and I guess it was shocking because she seemed to be a person who had everything in the world going for her. She was incredibly intelligent. She was beautiful. She was on national television on this program called Extra. She had been Miss USA. What could possibly drive her to take her own life? That's the single thing that kept going through my mind. I'm sure this was a shock for you, but was it unimaginable for you, given what you knew about your daughter?
Chesley had a first attempt before some of those markers. And if success was the cure for mental illness, we wouldn't be fighting it as hard as we do. And many people look at accomplishments and look at status in life and assume that those things can solve everything and make you happy enough that it will drown out a mental illness. And that is not so. And, my hope is when people read this book, that they really, instead of trying to find a something, a pivotal moment, that they will understand this was someone who was dealing with persistent depression. Her words, it followed her through every accomplishment, family dinner. In sharing that, in revealing that, no, I think after her first attempt, and I'm there as any desperate, loving parent would be, and begging God for more time with my child. That moment moving forward, I had no choice but to live every day like it was our last, not really knowing whether or not it would be. I think the level of shock felt by some was different than the pain that I felt.
You mentioned that she talks about the persistent depression that she dealt with. You know, when we have a sprained ankle or we have appendicitis, we know how to deal with that. We know how to
Right.
fix those things. There's no stigma attached to that. You just go to the doctor, you get it done, and it's over. You move on. But this depression thing, for somebody, we all go through bouts of depression, but the kind of
Yes.
depression that she suffered from, and she is not alone in suffering from this type of depression, it's difficult for people who don't experience that to understand. Do you understand it?
I absolutely understand it 100%. There is a difference between major depressive disorder and persistent depressive disorder. There are two different things. And one of the challenges with persistent depressive disorder is it doesn't seem that bad even to the person who is challenged with it. That's their state. It's almost like you need a comparison to know that, oh, I should feel very happy. Why don't I? And it's almost deceptive. It's like having a low-grade headache that never quite goes away. If you've always had that, it's almost hard to know what life is like without that. But that low-grade headache is having an impact on you every single day.
Do
And so,
doctors understand this? I mean, do we have any clue as to what is going on that causes that?
Yes, I had an opportunity to speak with a psychiatrist who really studies high functioning depression, which, those two have been kind of used together, persistent depressive disorder and high functioning depression. And, yes, I do believe there are a number of doctors who are trying to study this and figure out what chemically may be out of alignment. I'm certainly no psychiatrist. I don't study medicine. But I do know that there are physicians and professionals and experts who are trying to understand this.
You were on CBS Mornings with Gayle King not too long ago, and they started that segment with something that Chesley recorded on video, talking about the book that she had just finished.
It's so wild. Like, I wrote a book. There are words on this page. My words that I wrote, my thoughts and like what happened and my account of important events in my life.
Now, she recorded that just very shortly before she took her life, and she sounds excited, thrilled even by the prospect of what she had just accomplished, and yet it
Yes.
wasn't enough. That compounds the tragedy, at least for me. I mean, how can we wrap our heads around that?
Truthfully, there are some things that there are some puzzles I don't try to solve. Understanding, even in the book, when Chesley is sharing those invasive thoughts that come to her, and you hear her trying to talk through them, I'm sure with the help of tools she was equipped with from working with counselors, it is ongoing. And so I think at any point in her life, there was a reason for her to continue fighting. But that's a daily fight. And to use her own words, depression won that time around. One time, depression won that time around.
So as she walked through life, would you say that she wore a mask, that she felt compelled to be the happy-looking, cheerful, competent, intelligent woman that she was, and she had to wear this mask so that people wouldn't know what was going on inside?
I think there's a difference between wearing a mask and keeping your private life private. There were people who knew Chesley was battling. I was not the only person who knew there was a first attempt. I was not the only person who supported her. It's just in that public, very public, judged life that she chose to keep it private, not secret.
When did you know? When did the signs of her mental health problems first surface for you?
The first time I noticed that there was something a little off was not long before her first attempt. Chesley was always a high achiever, so it was not surprising if she seemed fatigued or tired. She was an athlete, she volunteered, she did so many things, so why wouldn't at some point she appear fatigued or tired? But it was one occasion when it just seemed a little more so than others. And that was a moment that I thought something may not be right.
April Simpkins is our guest. She's Chesley Christ's mother, and she has helped to publish Chesley's book. By the time you read this, The Space Between Chesley's Smile and Mental Illness, we'll come back and talk more about that and about Chesley's life and her contributions when we come back at Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, using Mazda's customer-centric approach to cars to create a car buying and servicing experience where the customer is the center of their business. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and WFAE.org. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking to April Simpkins this morning, ambassador for the National Alliance on Mental Illness, but more importantly, the mother of Chesley Christ. And she helped her daughter get her book published posthumously. But by the time you read this, The Space Between Chesley's Smile and Mental Illness. By the way, as we go through this conversation, you can call or text 988 to reach the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline, to reach free live support if you or someone you love or you know has thoughts of suicide or mental health or substance abuse crisis or any other kind of emotional distress. That's 988. They've made it very easy. We played a little clip of Chesley just a moment ago talking just prior to the publication or just immediately after she finished her book. And she was very excited about it. And she wanted to share that excitement I guess it was on social media with her followers. Yet in the preface to this book that you had published for her, you write, quote, "The first time I read your manuscript, I was looking for something, maybe answers or a revelation, perhaps a specific moment or event that might shed light on the feelings you wrote about, loneliness, hopelessness, sadness. You were very close. You knew about your daughter. You shared intimate conversations with her about all kinds of things. Did you learn something from reading that manuscript that you didn't know?"
I did. I learned the depth of her pain. I knew that Chesley was battling. And I so appreciate the final words she shared with me, because it did answer a lot of questions when she said, "I haven't wanted to share this pain with anyone." We talked often. I knew how to support her. You know, let me be clear, I was not her counselor, I was not her therapist. I was her mother and a supporter. And I knew how to proceed with my role in allowing her space to not be okay. But the level at which she would share with me, that's her choice. And if she chose to keep that level of pain from me, I have to accept that.
In the aftermath of this tragedy, social media came into play, as it did with your daughter, which we'll talk about later. But people started criticizing you for not knowing that your daughter was going through this horrible time, and you not being able to help or not helping, which just emphasizes to me what I've always said: people should stay the heck off social media, particularly if you don't know the person you're talking about. Just leave them alone. But you told People magazine that mental illness is a fight that you cannot fight for your child. You have to learn how to equip them with the tools so that they can continue to go nine rounds. And that's hard. Watching someone with a mental illness, you say, is hard. So what can people do to help? If you know somebody that you know or love is going through something like this, what can you do? What should you do?
There are a few things you need to do. One, I tell people, whether you know someone or have someone in your circle or assume, go out and get certified in mental health first aid, because it really is going to help you with how to have that conversation. When I talk about learning to listen to someone, I repeat this constantly. My people will talk at me and not listen to me. And learning to listen to someone and give them space to not be okay and not try to fix them is work that you have to do on yourself, which is why it's important that you are seeking counseling on how to be a support and not try to save someone. And feeling, I think for some people, when you feel like your role is to save them or rescue them, that if they do pass by suicide, that you have failed them or you've done less than was expected. And so it's really important. I've been in counseling for decades. It's just a part of how I support my own mental health through the years. And understanding that distinction will help people be a better supporter.
Which leads to an obvious question, which I hesitate to ask, but looking back, as you said, she did not share with you the depth of her pain, and you read about it in her manuscript. But looking back on some of the things that you did know about, do you have any regrets? Is there anything that you think you could have done now, knowing what you know now, differently, that would have course-corrected her life?
Such a great question. There are some things that I would do differently and have begun to do differently. And I want to go back a little bit You had asked the question, when did I know? And when I was there with her in the hospital after her first attempt and talking with, you know, medical doctors and the psychiatrist, that is when I first heard her diagnosis and really tried to digest it and then began looking back at what sign was there. But when I look all the way back, one thing that I wish I had done differently myself is to be very transparent with how I'm feeling and where my mental health is. And I could have those conversations with Chesley because I felt that was part of me being a support, but I didn't always do that with my other children. And I believe that was just my mom instinct of not wanting them to worry about me, of wanting them to know, or at least believe, that I was okay. And so I wore that kind of brave face. And that's something that I have learned to not do. I have learned that in front of my children, I don't have to be the hero. In front of my children, I need to show them what it is to be human and what it is to have a bad day and what it means to not be okay and how to move past that.
She did not share the depths of her depression with you, and she was a very private person about that part of her life to a great extent, from what I understand from reading through this and our conversation this morning. But she did choose to share some of her pain in this book, and she would have published, I believe, this book had she lived. Yeah. Why was she so closed about it in life and to you when she's willing to be more open about it in the pages of a book?
I think her reasons were different, and so I want to just show some distinction there. When you love someone, the deeper and harder you love them, you do not ever want to cause them pain of any sort. So Chesley is not unique in wanting to keep a pain to herself. We see this in many stories of people who privatize some of their challenge. Chesley's reasons for not wanting to share her struggle publicly had a lot more to do with the judgmental trolls on social media, who even on her best day found ways to criticize her, either in comments or in direct messaging. So that is a protection of her mental health, where the other is trying to protect someone else from the depth of a pain.
You said just a second ago that people who are going through this don't want to inflict that pain on the people that they love. They keep it to themselves and they let you go off and live your life oblivious, happily unaware. And people take their lives for various reasons. At the root of it, probably every time, is pain. And not even understanding what that pain really is. But it's a pain over which they feel they have no control. And the only solution is to end it so that they don't feel it anymore. But in the process, it strikes me that the very people that they're trying to protect from their pain are going to be inflicted with undescribable pain in the aftermath, which is exactly what happened. Is this something that they just don't think through?
I don't know that I can answer that question. I have read the stories of other suicide attempt survivors, and I see varying reasons. Some feel like they are going to be inflicting less pain on people if they're not there. They feel like their pain is hurting people. And so I think there's a variety of reasons. I think one of the mistakes that is made, and I'm hoping to broaden these conversations, is that suicide is a monolith, or depression looks the same in everyone, or the reasons are the same for everyone. And this is why we've got to learn to listen. We have to open these conversations so we can all learn. I can share the parts of Chesley's story that I am familiar with, but Chesley's story isn't the same story as the person next door.
I spoke years ago on this program with a young man who had survived jumping from the Golden Gate Bridge. Most people do not. Mm. And he told me that the instant that his feet left the railing of that bridge, he regretted it. Mm. And all of the things that he thought he was leaving behind, he wanted to embrace, essentially, and be with his folks, his people, his loved ones. What would you say to somebody who is contemplating taking their own lives, no matter the method? Is there anything that you can say that could bring them back from the brink?
That's a really good question. I don't know that I would have the words for everyone. It's why it's so important for people to seek counseling, because they give you those words. And I was fortunate that Chesley shared some of those tools with me so that I could remind her and reiterate those things. You know, I closed the book back, closed the book out with saying that you need to give your own self space and grace and fight to live another day, because for many with a mental illness, it is a daily battle. And I do believe for some who have attempted to take their own life, that they will realize after the fact that that was a very difficult moment, and that there is help and tools, and are, you know, probably feeling a sense of relief that they did survive and can fight another day. Yeah. Again, when Chesley wrote her final words to me, I'm going to believe every word she wrote. And what Chesley said is, I'd wished for death for years, and that I kept her alive. And I have to accept that this was a daily struggle. And I give her so much praise for fighting every single day for all of those years.
Yeah. We're talking to April Simpkins. She's Chesley Christ's mother. For those who don't remember, Chesley Christ was a former Miss USA. She was on, she had a burgeoning career in entertainment journalism on the program Extra. She had many other accomplishments to her credit as well. And April has published her daughter's book by the time you read this, The Space Between Chesley's Smile and Mental Illness. You say that Chesley was driven from a very young age to succeed at everything, and everything had to be just so. And that a guidance counselor, I think she was in middle school, and a guidance counselor cautioned you that her drive could lead to burnout. How do you read her drive? What does a mother do with that kind of information? Because normally that's good news,
right? You know, I won't try to sugarcoat this. I was pretty proud of her drive. I did not see that caution until that guidance counselor said that, because I really thought, you know, she gave Chesley all kind of accolades, you know, what her drive helped her accomplish, but was very careful to also let us know that in addition to that drive, you need to have brakes. It's like the gas pedal, and you got to have a brake. And her drive was so strong that it would impede her brake. And that can cause burnout. And the problem with burnout is it taxes your mind. So if you are already dealing with intrusive thoughts, is your mind strong enough to continue to counter those things? And I understand that, you know, a lot better later in her life when I would watch her. But that was certainly an eye-opening moment, because we do want our children to excel. People brag all the time, my kid made the dean's list or the, you know, something else, some accolade. But at what cost sometimes?
She was the kind of person that if she had to write a paper for school and somewhere in that paper she had to cross out a word because she got it wrong, she'd rewrite the whole thing because it wasn't perfect. That, to me, that I'm not an expert by any means, but that there's a little OCD in that behavior. Do you think that kind of thought process led her to not be able to live up to her own expectations, which created this sense of sadness in her, because she couldn't be the perfect person she strived to be?
I can't answer that question. I don't know all of her thought process. I can only answer questions from, you know, my perspective as her mom. But there were times when Chesley accepted loss. She accepted defeat. She grew stronger in her faith. And many times, you know, when she would speak before audiences or, you know, places in her book, she would look at those losses as God closing one door and opening another. And so I believe that's a tool she used in her mind to grow, to accept. You don't win every single time, but something good could come of this. And, you know, I was proud of her for adopting that tool that she would use.
She, except for her mental health problems, which are over which she had no control and no one is to blame for, because that's just the way it is. She was very much, I didn't know her, but from what I've read about her, she strikes me as being very much like you. Very put together, very, very accomplished, intelligent. I don't even have a question for that. It's just... I'm just wondering where you think that comes from, where it came from in her. Did you guide her that way? Did you and your family, I know you don't want to talk about your other children, but are they similar in that way? Because she was wonderful.
Oh, well, thank you. I am that way, you know, without going through all of my own personal struggles, as a child, I did learn somewhere in my youth that there was this correlation between, you know, kind of markers of success and hard work. So I became a very hard worker from a young age. The things that I instilled in my children had a lot more to do with curiosity, being coachable, being able to be open your mind to certain things. And I think that they picked up on that. There are things that I do very well that I love that Chesley picked up, and there are things that I constantly critique because I'm concerned my children will pick those things up.
April Simpkins is our guest. She is Chesley Crist's mom. She helped publish her daughter's book by the time you read this. She's also an ambassador for the National Alliance on Mental Illness, and you can call 988 to reach the suicide prevention hotline or lifeline to reach free live support if you or someone you know is thinking about that or has other mental health or substance abuse challenges. We're coming right back with more in a moment. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, incorporating Mazda's customer-centric vehicle design by making the customer the center of business to create a better car buying experience. More at MazdaOfSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. April Simpkins is our guest, Chesley Crist's mom. Chesley Crist, former Miss USA, and her book is called By the Time You Read This, The Space Between Chesley's Smile and Mental Illness. Her mother got that book published posthumously. But let's go back to early in Chesley's story. She was, as we've said, a high achiever. Very high intelligence, also beautiful, and both she put both her beauty and her intelligence to work throughout her adult life. She was, as I said earlier, the complete package. But in an early chapter of the book, she writes about being in the seventh grade and realizing in the seventh grade that she was neither popular nor pretty. I'm assuming if either of those things are true, you can chalk that up to just the awkward stage that all teenagers go through. But if you think of yourself as not being popular or not being pretty, why do you go into pageants?
A great question. And I loved her transparency in the book when she said she did it initially for validation. And, you know, there's this strange dichotomy between your parents telling you how beautiful you are and all of these other accolades and the, you know, the bully at school and the kids at school telling you something different or using different markers as beauty or intelligence. And I do think that middle school is such a weird place. You're stuck right in the middle. Whose markers do you use? The ones your parents told you, which, you know, they accept because they see a beauty deeper than what is physical or what other kids are telling you. And so I love that she was so transparent when she said she just wanted validation.
I was going to ask a deeper question as to why she might have pursued pageantry, but you can share if you want to, but I think I know her motivation because she spoke with one of our producers, Sarah D'Elia, several years ago, right after she had won, I think, a major pageant. And she told Sarah that you had competed in pageants, that you were the second Black Mrs. North Carolina, and she saw you enjoy the fruits of that accomplishment.
I remember my mom was in a parade in Charlotte, and I remember being like 10 or 11 years old, sitting at the sideline of the parade, watching her literally in a white carriage, horse-drawn, in this like mint green evening gown. And I just thought, like, she is the coolest person in the world. You know, she would go places and people would listen to her. People would want her to sign autographs. People would want to know what her thoughts were on different issues. And I just remember thinking she's so powerful and just so cool, and I wanted to be just like her.
That was right after she won Miss USA. Did you know the impression that you had made on her?
I didn't know the full extent at the time because she was quite young, and learned it through the years when she would kind of point to some of those things. She went through quite an evolution, to use her words, between the time the first pageant she entered in, her reasons why, and certainly when she went to step on that Miss USA stage and what her reasons were. I think she realized at some point that there is some power that comes, you know, that crown brings with it a megaphone that allows you to highlight things that are important. And it gave her that opportunity.
Chesley was an attorney. She had two law degrees. She had just won Miss USA. She was on national television. And yet she writes about something you've already mentioned earlier in the conversation, that is having imposter syndrome. What did she tell you about that, if anything?
It wasn't often that we used that word, but there were times in conversations we had when it would spill out this, you know, I'm really not qualified, or I don't think I'll do well in that. Or she will cite, she'll do a brilliant job at something, and she'll cite a comment that someone made. And I begin to learn over time that when she cites that small comment or that look, it's because it hit a nerve that was closely tied to her imposter syndrome. And, you know, it's in those moments that I had to learn how to listen. I can't come firing back with, don't even think of that. That's, you know, not true, or you know, but I have to learn how to listen and sit with her in that space and allow her to build a dialogue in her head that would counter that.
I think a lot of people have those feelings of not being who they, the person that they are projecting and that the world sees in their interior lives. They think, that's not who I am. I'm going to be found out for being an imposter. But those feelings are usually fleeting. For her, they were not. Do you think they are also somehow connected in some way to her drive to be such an overachiever? But she couldn't see her own accomplishments.
You know, I would have to say yes, that may be the way her brain processed those things. If I go all the way back to her writing a paper and having to scratch out a word and then wanting to rewrite that paper to eliminate that scratch, you know, whether or not that computes in her mind to that, you know, that comment and her wanting to then push harder to kind of clear that out of her brain. Possibly, but again, I'm only basing it on some conversations I had with Chesley. I can't speak for Chesley. Yeah.
And then there's this social media component. I am not a fan of social media. I just find it ridiculous, but that's just me. And I know that it's out there and everybody in the known universe uses it, but we also know that a lot of young people that's the source of their depression because of the terrible things that are said back and forth on these various platforms. When Chesley won Miss USA, I believe in that same year, Miss America and Miss Universe were both Black women. So she was the third Black woman to have this title. And Black was not always considered beautiful because it had been the purview of white women. That is a standard that had been set traditionally in our society by white women. And I think of that as being ancient history, but Chesley told a story about that to Sarah D'Elia, our Sarah D'Elia here, which brings that outdated perspective into contemporary times.
I went to Fort Mill High School. I love Fort Mill High School, but I remember being a cheerleader. I honestly can't remember who it was. I think it was like a fellow student who we were just like talking about something. And at one point in time, I remember her saying like, well, you're really pretty for a black girl. And she said it like almost as if it was like a compliment. I think she meant it as a compliment and just didn't understand like exactly what she was saying. And so I think, you know, that memory really stood out for me because there are some people who will say things that are incredibly offensive, but they don't mean it that way. They're saying it because they really just don't understand the significance of the words that are coming out of their mouths. And so I try to be understanding with people who, you know, express their opinions, but those opinions may be hurtful or may be offensive because not everybody just really understands.
That comment may have struck a deep nerve. I don't know. Maybe you don't know either, but it goes without saying that if somebody says that to you, it has to hurt. And yet, she showed tremendous grace in that response, tremendous forgiveness, and a display of her own understanding of the failings of others. And yet, she couldn't live up to her own accomplishments. Where did this grace in her come from?
You know, first I will say that was Chesley's nature, but I will also say that is my nature. I don't like to assume. I really prefer to educate, and I don't assume that people have, you know, my lived experience, but I do welcome the opportunity to educate them on my lived experience. And I do believe in that way, Chesley and I were very similar. I myself will hear comments that would almost strike me first as offensive, and I use it as a learning opportunity. As a matter of fact, whenever I'm talking in front of audiences about topics that might be seen as a little unnerving in the workplace, especially surrounding DEI, one of the first things I'll say is, in addition to getting comfortable being uncomfortable, let's view missteps as learning opportunities. And I say that because I believe that.
One of the things, I had the privilege of listening to that. I just took little snippets out of it, but I had the privilege of listening to that entire conversation with our Sarah D'Elia. And one of the things that struck me was how relaxed, how happy, how well adjusted she seemed. But her win was rewarded, and we're coming back to social media. It was rewarded on social media by some hateful comments about her looks. And she included a few in her book, like, the only people that think she was the most beautiful are the black women. That's a quote. One suggested that she kill herself. Mm-hmm. Now, this is not a reflection on Chesley. It's a reflection on the people who made those comments and felt able to post them for all the world to see on social media, and more importantly, for her to see on social media. What kind of toll does that take on someone who is already struggling with mental health issues?
Oh, I think, I would be remiss if I said it didn't affect her. You know, one thing Chesley would caution me, because, you know, I would see those comments too, and as a mother who is very protective and knowing that my daughter is struggling, I would want to come firing back, and Chesley would always caution me and say, Mom, don't read the comments. And then she would go further and say, the people making those comments are people who don't know me. They are people who are responding to something they think or assume. And she was 100% correct. I never, ever once saw people who truly loved her or who were close to her make a comment like that.
Do people who make comments, this happens all the time. It's happening right now as we speak. It could be happening about this conversation on social media.
Absolutely. But
do the people who make those comments, who feel free enough to say terrible, hateful, disgusting things, are they suffering from a mental health issue?
You know, I'd like to think you'd have to be to go that low And so personal. I do think it's a projection of your own pain. I mean, we've said this for years, hurt people hurt people. And so, you know, it's why I keep championing this, you know, just be kind. And I say that, and then I'll see something happen and social media will explode with a lot of unkindness, and then assume that somehow all of that unkindness compounded will not impact that person's mental health. And was that your goal to begin with? Yeah. I'm glad that, you know, while some of it obviously broke through, that Chesley had developed a way to deal with that. And I honestly have adopted a number of the things that she said.
There is no good way for a parent or anyone to find out about a loved one who has decided to take their life. There is no right. good way. You found out, I think, in probably the worst way imaginable. Yeah. You found out in a text that your daughter sent to you. It began, quote, "First, I'm sorry. By the time you get this, I won't be alive anymore. And it makes me even more sad to write this, because I know it will hurt you the most." And she detailed the pain that she was living through. She wrote, "I cannot bear the crushing weight of persistent sadness, hopelessness, and loneliness any longer. I cry almost every day now like I'm in mourning. I no longer feel like I have any purpose in life. I don't know if I ever really did." You read that at a stoplight in your car. I know you write about in the book what you did next, but what did you do next?
I shared with someone else when I go back to that day and those moments that it's almost like my brain processes it in snapshots. I've heard many people say that the brain will protect you from, you know, traumatic experiences. And so some of it comes back to me. But I remember when my hands started shaking because I was trying to call her. I remember screaming. And it was honestly, it was just startling. The shock of it in that moment of trying to absorb that. You know, I mentioned in the book that sometime before Chesley passed, within about 7 days of her passing, Chesley and I had a very serious conversation about death, dying, loss, suicide. And we were talking specifically about, I was talking about two mothers who had lost their sons. One, a neighbor, another, a very famous woman who lost her son to suicide. So we had had this conversation, and she was telling me, she was comforting me, because I was telling her I couldn't take the pain of losing one of my children. And she was comforting me with her words, telling me how strong I was. And I know in hindsight that the text message that she sent, all of those words were really to help me understand not just the depth of her pain, but to comfort me, because we just had this very intimate conversation. And between that conversation and the words in her message, when I look back on it now, I am comforted.
I have a little less than a minute left. In the book, in that same text message, Chesley tells you that you had done nothing wrong, that you'd done everything right, that you were a great mom. She was trying to obviously ease what she knew would be terrible pain for you. Did it work? Did those words comfort you?
Yes, they absolutely did. They still do. They still do.
It should be noted that the proceeds from the sale of this book, by the time you read this, The Space Between Chesley's Smile and Mental Illness, will go to the Chesley Crist Foundation, and its work supports mental health programs for children and for young adults. And if you or someone you know is suffering from mental illness and needs help, you can call the National Alliance on Mental Illness Helpline, of which April is a board member. That number is 800-950-6264. Or once again, you can call or text 988 to reach the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline for free live support. April Simpkins, very sorry for your loss, but thank you for the hour. Really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Celebrating 25 years on the air, Charlotte Talks with Mike Collins is a production of 90.7 WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from Mazda of South Charlotte. Our executive producer is Wendy Herkey. The senior producers are Gabe Altieri and Sarah D'Elia. Our engineer is Joby Sprinkle. For more information about Charlotte Talks, to listen to past episodes, or subscribe to the podcast, visit wfae.org/charlottetalks. Additional support for WFAE programming comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at mazdaofsouthcharlotte.com.